Hi, Jeffrey.
Hello, Jackie. How are you?
Oh, I've had better mornings.
Yeah, it sounds like things are a little crazy there at the Shire household.
You know when, like, the cameras aren't working right and you have 15 minutes before you're supposed to start logging Hits TV and
you
don't know where the manual is? But, you know, I took a deep breath. Well, no, first I called my husband. And then I just said, you know, I'm going to have to fix this problem myself. So I figured out where the serial number was, found the manual online, figured out how to work the menu button. Anyway, I'm very empowered now. That's the bottom line.
Outstanding.
I turned the camera off demonstration mode. Anyway.
Okay.
So we have a lot to talk about today.
Yes. But mostly irrelevant to the big news, right?
Yeah, the big news is General Petraeus' report on the status of things in Iraq, which we're really not the sort of expert analysts, except that you are.
I do want to get the plug in. We don't have a date yet, but my old office mate and my friend, who is a The Atlantic Monthly called him the geographer Tim Golden, which makes him kind of sound cool. And he is cool. Is going to talk about statistics. Because it turns out that a lot of this stuff about how the violence is up or down is not based on anything that we would consider reliable accounting. So I think it'll be an interesting talk. We'll probably have it toward the end of the month.
So we don't have any views about the Petraeus report, which, of course, I haven't seen yet.
No. I mean, other than the fact that, you know, they claim to have statistics in it, and that's almost certainly not actually going to be the case.
And from our sort of narrow, you know, interest, there's always the issue of Iran and you know,
right.
what kind of role it's playing there. So, you know, I'll certainly be curious about, you know, what General Petraeus has to say about Iran's impact on the insurgency.
Indeed. Particularly since, you know, that along with the whole nuclear program may be one of the two causes that lie.
Right. Okay.
Not sure. My sister, the Latin speaker, might correct the way that I handled those two words. But
wait, say those words again?
Causes belli.
Causes belli.
But I don't know how to make it plural.
I don't think I see. Yeah, it would be C-A-S-I. I took a lot of Latin in high school, and it's just all faded. Okay, Iran. There's some really important stuff out about Iran, and I'm hoping you and I can kind of get to the quick of it and explain our sort of disagreement.
Though, I mean,
not that it's not to put too fine a point on it, but the big
news. But now, I mean, maybe we agree because we just had that really cool meeting, right?
We
did. Where we talked about what kind of valves were on the cascades.
Yes.
And all kinds
and
of.
And whether Iran is using its own UF-6, which you'll have to go back and correct your blog post about.
Yes, you were right.
Okay. But
for those of you who are following at home, we had like a really technical, very, I thought exciting, which is, you know, nerd for boring, meeting, and Jackie corrected something I had missed. Which is, in fact, it does appear that the Iranians are using their own hex in their cascades. Sorry,
just because Bob warned me again about acronyms and abbreviations, uranium hexafluoride is the gas that is introduced into a centrifuge cascade and then enriched.
Mm-hmm.
But the big thing that has been controversial, there are two things that have happened. One is that the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, has reached an understanding with the government of Iran over a kind of work plan, a way forward to resolve a list of outstanding issues.
Yes, and also known as the modalities plan, which is a word I hate.
So you weren't too upset about this work plan. David Albright and I put out a paper saying that this work plan is horrible. Flawed.
You called it the devil's work?
We called it flawed. We were not to overstate it. It's not horrible. It's just flawed. It's just got some flaws in it. And you weren't too upset about it. And
no.
I just want to say briefly why I think this work plan is flawed. And it's just for a couple of simple reasons. The first is that the document puts the onus on the IAEA to tell Iran by September 15, in 5 days, give Iran a list of questions, a sort of full, final, complete list of questions that it has about any aspect of its past nuclear activities. And then Iran will undertake in sort of a series of increments to address each issue, after which that file will be closed. And these are sort of magic words in UN, IAEA, Iran, Iraq parlance, where when you close a file, it doesn't really get reopened. And if other issues come up, it's very hard to reopen them. Anyway, I see all of this as kind of not only sloppy word choice, but bad precedent setting. And
right.
I don't like the idea that the IAEA has to come up with a final list of questions for Iran, and I don't like the idea that while Iran continues to be in violation of some UN Security Council resolutions, it sort of changes the terms of the dialogue
right. And
gets to kind of wave around a piece of paper saying, we're good guys now, we're cooperating, everything's good. You know, the fact that we're now running between 2,000 and 3,000 uranium gas centrifuges, that's beside the point. And I kind of think that's not beside the point. So that's my two cents on why I think this work plan is flawed.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I disagree for a couple of reasons. One is, even though I'm not crazy about the schedule and the procedures that they laid out, the fact that the Iranians have agreed to a timetable to answer the questions, I think, is a huge benefit. And I'm actually quite skeptical that even given that it's a very favorable timeline for them, that they can do it. And if they could do it, I think that would be great. Second is, I understand what you mean about the file being closed, but at some level, you know, the IAEA has a limited legal mandate. I mean, it's up to the Iranians to declare certain things and for the IAEA to verify the accuracy and completeness of those declarations. But, you know, it's not really up to the IAEA to say whether or not Iran can have or have not centrifuges. And so to the extent that there are certain things that are within the IAEA's legal competence, you know, that's all they can resolve. And I agree with you, of course, that the resolution of all of the safeguards violations doesn't get the Iranians in the clear.
Right.
And then I guess the final thing is, I really think that a lot of this debate comes down to whether or not we have faith in the IAEA as an institution. I mean, we were talking about this at the meeting. I mean, if you think that the IAEA can't formulate sensible questions or is going to hastily accept even lousy Iranian answers, then it's a bad deal. But there is no good deal that can be reached if you don't think the IAEA can do its job. So,
yeah, I mean,
for that reason, I kind of think that, you know, this is a, I agree with you, it's flawed, but it's a passable agreement
right. Within
the IAEA's competence that has the potential to settle a small part of what is still a very large set of disputes that we have with the Iranians. But, I mean, to the IAEA's credit, I mean, a lot of people, myself and you, both complain that the work plan doesn't require Iran to get into the addition to not get into, but to resume adherence to the additional protocol.
Right.
But the IAEA report does. It says that they will not or cannot verify that Iran's activities are peaceful unless Iran takes additional steps beyond that laid out in the work plan.
And let's I just want to explain so people understand, you know, when we say additional protocol, it's such a wonky and vague term. But really what this means is without Iran adhering to the additional protocol, the IAEA has no ability to know how many centrifuges Iran is producing. The IAEA
right. Can
visit its workshops, the IAEA can still conduct unannounced or surprise inspections, but it without the additional protocol, it is confined to a much more narrow
right. Knowledge
base.
And it's worth noting that, I mean, this is a problem that we've had in the safeguards regime as a whole, right, which is that the safeguards regime just wasn't what it needed to be until the additional protocol, right, which is an additional protocol to past safeguards agreements, you know, was sort of promulgated in the 1990s, and countries have been slowly coming into agreement with it. So
I don't know what the number's up to now, but it's the vast majority of countries with safeguards agreements. It's the vast majority.
But, I mean, the point is that Iran doesn't have a legal obligation, although they may now, to adopt the protocol. And so, it's kind of whiny on their part, right? But, I mean, we are at some level saying that we don't trust them because of things they've done. And so at some level they have to accept either additional restrictions that other countries don't or at the very least, you know, the very highest standards. And, you know, I mean, I think that's good that we insist on that because they have violated their safeguards agreement, or at the very least, they've done things that indicate to me intent to violate it. And so they should be held to a higher standard. But, you know, you're going to get all the kind of whining.
Right. Well, you know, I think you put your finger on the nub of an issue that deserves further discussion, and that is this. Lots of people complain when people like you or David Albright or myself take these hardcore positions about Iran's centrifuge program. Well, why don't you have the same standard for Brazil? Or why don't you have the same standard for Israel? And I think it would be useful to kind of talk about this and maybe to try to get at the issue of whether there is some kind of compromise or middle ground that's acceptable that would leave Iran with some enrichment capability. And so I'm just going to answer that for myself and for the think tank that I'm affiliated with. You know, we've taken the position that no centrifuge enrichment in Iran is the right answer. We've taken the position that zero centrifuges is. But I think that it's a very legitimate question to say, what about Brazil?
Right.
And so I have some thoughts about that, but I wanted to kind of give you a chance
The argument that I make against zero centrifuges, I mean, my preference would be for Iran to have no centrifuges, too. But, I mean, ultimately, what we're trying to establish is, how many centrifuges are we going to allow Iran to have? Or, let me rephrase that, what nuclear activities are we going to allow Iran to conduct? And, you know, it's their right to conduct some large number of them. And under what safeguards, under what monitoring arrangements? And the problem with zero centrifuges, to me, is that we can't verify zero with current arrangements, given Iran's past deceptions and the level of confidence that we require. And so, you know, we are stuck in the position of, if we go for zero, saying, not only do you have to disassemble the 3,000 centrifuges, nearly 3,000 centrifuges that you've built, you have to take on additional monitoring requirements above and beyond what any other country has.
But the answer to that is you're arguing you can't monitor zero. People would argue if you give Iran 2,000 or 3,000, you can't monitor any number beyond that either, because any, say, IEA inspection goes in.
I'm sorry, but I don't mean that. I mean you can't monitor zero now. You'd need to impose additional requirements on the Iranians.
Right. Well,
so how do you get the Iranians to agree to more requirements? I mean,
I think the European Union, you know, and I'm not saying that their proposal was perfect. I thought their proposal was pretty imperfect, for other reasons. But I mean, just looking at the issue of how you get Iran to say, how you get Iran to the cost benefit calculus to say the costs are too high, the cost that the international community has imposed on us to have these 3,000 centrifuges. The cost is too high relative to what we're getting out of it. I think that's the calculus that is important to make, not only for Iran, but also for Brazil and for other countries. You just do it in different ways for different countries. And, you know, frankly, the world isn't worried about a Brazilian nuclear weapons program.
Right.
The world was worried about a Brazilian nuclear weapons program at one time, and now there are some very elaborate confidence-building security arrangements that have taken away that concern, not to mention the Brazilian government's own, you know, rhetoric is not at
that
all.
That gets to the nub of it, though, right?
Which is,
I mean, what we had in Brazil was we had a change in government. I mean, we had a military dictatorship that was replaced by a democracy. The democracy admitted that there had been a nuclear weapons program. They provided a whole bunch of information. And then they took additional steps. And so, I mean, I really think that nails the difference, which is, the fact is, we don't trust this government in Iran with sharp objects, which, you know,
right,
you might say about some other governments that we know.
Right. So in answering the accusation of double standards, I think it's really fair to just admit that Iran and Brazil are very different countries. But here's the other thing. Brazil's enrichment program maybe doesn't make economic sense either, and maybe the challenge is really to kind of advance these initiatives, to push them forward, that persuade the current non-enriching countries in the world who want to have peaceful nuclear energy programs to sign on to this notion of an assured fuel supply or the fuel bank. Maybe you want to explain what the fuel bank is?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to do a great job, because I think this is an idea that probably won't do any harm, but isn't going to do any good. But I'll explain it. I mean, the idea is that the international community creates a reserve, a, a bank, you know, a lockbox of fuel for reactors, so that in the event that a country like Iran gets its fuel cut off from Russia for political reasons, they can get the fuel from this bank. And the advantage of the bank is then we could say to Iran, you don't need to build your own capacity to produce fuel, which, you know, is a capacity also to produce a nuclear weapon. You can just rely on this bank. The problem that I have with that proposal is pretty clearly demonstrated by the U.S. bill to fund a fuel bank. The U.S. bill says that the fuel in the fuel bank cannot be used to support fuel in a country that's on the list of state sponsors of terrorism. Which, you know, I mean, it would seem to me that the fuel bank, that if you're worried about the international community ganging up on you and cutting off your fuel, I don't see how the fuel bank would be seen as any more reliable than, you know, the Russians.
Well, and of course what Iran says is it has a small 10% stake in in Eurodiff. It's a gaseous diffusion plant, and that they haven't seen, you know, 1 ounce of enrichment product from that investment. And they're, of course, they don't have confidence that the fuel bank would work. So, these are hard problems, and there's no getting around them, and there's no getting around the double standard issue with Israel or Brazil. But I just think people have to be honest and say Ahmadinejad's government, as you said, is not the same as is it Lula da Silva in Brazil? I can't remember.
Lula, I think. I just like
anyway. So
saying Lula.
Yeah, Lula. It's not the same, and so
right.
There's not a one size fits all strategy for uranium enrichment across the world.
You know what I would say to agree with you, and I thought David made this point pretty articulately at the last meeting, which is that at some level, I mean, we're just buying time, right? I mean, if your goal is to keep Iran from getting a bomb, you might just have to wait them out. And so a slow sanctions process might work. I mean, we do have this case of South Africa where we applied sanctions and we waited. And they ended up building 6 bombs, but then eventually the government changed and then they gave them back up. And that is probably a pretty good case study. Although it's hard to imagine sustaining that as a strategy in the United States.
You know, one thing I just want to say about South Africa, I actually went through all of the UN Security Council resolutions on South Africa, which were adopted in the 70s and 80s. I don't want to say I went through all of them, but there were like many. And remarkably, I think I only found one that mentioned South Africa's nuclear program, and it mentioned it in an oblique way. And of course, this is because of the politics of South Africa and apartheid were that the U.S. wasn't on the leading edge of countries far from it in the Security Council who wanted to sanction South Africa.
That is a very gentle way of saying that, Jackie.
But
is this
know,
the State Department experience coming out?
But there were different policies towards South Africa under Carter. And,
United
you know,
States
there
played
were
a vital reserve role.
Yes, yes. There were. So I don't want to like lump every. The 70s and 80s were a long time. But you know,
bottom line
was the U.S. wasn't supportive of strong Security Council action against South Africa. And I thought it was really interesting to go back and look at those resolutions and see how little the nonproliferation or the nuclear issue really played a role. And of course, the reason South Africa gave up its nuclear weapons were maybe because they wanted to be good guys, but also, frankly, because there were concerns about the non-apartheid government inheriting nuclear weapons. So there was a good deal of, you know, I don't know how you'd characterize that, pragmatism, racism, I mean, I don't know how you'd want to look at that, but it wasn't only because South Africa was trying to be, you know, solid.
No, but, you know, what I think is, I mean, this is what I thought was compelling about David's comment, is that there was this sort of recognition that this isn't always about nonproliferation, and there are always going to be other interests, and there are always going to be other ways that we manage the threat from Iran, and the government could change over time, and so, you know, it's a mistake to just give up, and there are two ways of giving up, right? One is to just give up and let them have a bomb, but the other is to give up and attack them, right? I mean,
right, absolutely, right.
You know, and the point is that if you assume if your assumption going in is that the regime in Iran is going to remain exactly the way it is today forever, then you're in a way skewing the debate already, right? Because if you really believe that, then coexistence might not be possible. I don't know, and so you could make all kinds of other reasons. But if you think that in some way Iran's actions are that of a government that has at times shown pragmatism, could become more pragmatic, or that to some extent, we're just not understanding the pragmatic decisions they are making, wherever you are on that spectrum, then it becomes a more complicated thing, and playing for time makes a lot of sense.
Definitely. And one thing I just think is interesting, and then we should move on to North Korea, is,
okay,
is that when the nonproliferation community first started worrying and wringing its hands over Iran's nuclear program, it had no centrifuges installed, or then it had,
right,
like 20, and then 164. I mean, it strikes me as really amazing that in a year, Iran has gone from basically 0 to 3,000, give or take, in less than a year, really.
Well, I mean, I don't know.
Well, you have one cascade out as of February 07.
But, I mean, a lot of that, they've been producing parts,
right,
and components, and they'd imported components, and
no,
so...
I'm not trying to suggest that there's been a giant technical achievement, because we know that Iran continues to kind of muddle through and have problems. But in terms of just changing the terms of the discussion,
wow. Yes.
I mean, in less than a year, the terms have been changed radically.
Totally. And I mean, that was the point, right?
That was their point, and they achieved their objective. And just to get back to the work plan, this is another example of Iran achieving its objective, really changing the terms of the discussion.
You were just not letting the work plan go.
I'm not. No, but it's last security council. I think that the EU and the US have all but given up the idea of further Security Council action on Iran this fall. And the work plan played a part in that, but I just think it's remarkable how Iran has really stayed in control of the agenda. And maybe with Mr. Bumbling President Ahmadinejad, very effectively changed the terms of the discussion to its advantage.
Well, I mean, and this is actually, I think, a nice segue to Korea, because I think in a lot of ways, one of the huge benefits of being sensible on Korea is that it starts to repair some of the credibility that we've lost on nonproliferation issues. I mean, it would seem to me that one of the reasons we haven't been able to keep the initiative on Iran is that the administration still seems pretty torn about what to do. And so we don't really have a policy, we don't have an approach. And that stands in marked contrast to Korea, where
peace has broken out.
Yeah, I mean, it's like sanity suddenly, seems to be,
yes,
on all sides.
Sanity
we'll
everywhere.
See how long that lasts.
And yes, okay. So, quick summary for people who might not be following North Korea.
Right.
They've agreed to dismantle. Actually, I didn't see the term disablement. I saw dismantlement.
Really?
Yeah, I saw dismantlement. I think I see it in a. I printed here an Associated Press piece. Kim Dae-gwon, head of the North Korean delegation, told reporters, "We made it clear we showed clear willingness to declare and dismantle all nuclear facilities." That could be casual translation.
Oh no, I think that is. I mean, that's the ultimate end goal. But gosh, this is such a good example of being totally wonky, right? Like,
right,
I've been obsessed with the interim steps of disablement.
Right.
I kind of forget that there's an end to this entire process.
Okay, so just to be clear, for people, distinguish between disablement and dismantlement. Of course, disablement means you have one of your reprocessing facility, for example, you simply disable it. You pull out the plugs, you turn out the lights.
Well, let's be blunt.
Dismantlement.
Disablement's a made-up word, right?
Yeah, it's a made-up word.
I'll be the partisan on this, because this kind of annoys me, because it links up my policy interests with my sort of pickiness about the English language, and I hate it when people do stuff like this. But the Clinton administration had a freeze on the North Korean nuclear program, and this administration kept saying, no interim measures, we're not going to have a freeze, we're going to go straight to dismantlement, no interim measures, they're
right,
going to give everything up, and then they get the benefits, we're going to be tough, we're not going to be
right,
weak like those
right,
Clinton guys, we're not going to get a freeze, and then they thought, oh, you know what, we'll take the freeze. But they didn't want to call it a freeze, so they're calling it disablement.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is short of dismantlement. Which...
And can we just make the added point that in the time it took the Bush administration to come around to this revelation, North Korea managed to separate enough plutonium for maybe, I don't know, 6 weapons?
Yeah.
That's a policy that's working for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, so, okay, disablement, right.
So I was a little annoyed about that, but nonetheless, bygones be bygones. Chris Hill is a wonderful man. He is doing God's work in North Korea.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to throw stones.
No, but do we know when the first piece, they've shut down the facility, but we don't know what, the hard work is really still ahead. I think that's the bottom line.
Right. We know there's a team, so... Basically, what happens is there are these working groups, right? And there's a denuclearization working group. And they met, the North Koreans and the U.S., in Geneva last week, I guess. And then this week, if they haven't already arrived, a U.S. team is going to Yongbyon, where the nuclear reactor and the reprocessing facilities are located, to do a site survey. And so apparently in Geneva... We came up with a whole bunch of proposals. They came up with a whole bunch of proposals, different ways to disable this reactor, basically dropping the control rods into the pile. Boy, you guys, that's probably too dorky. I explain it all on my blog. A whole bunch of really technical ways to disable the reactor, and the team now is going to go into North Korea, and they're actually going to look at the site and see if those are, in fact, practical.
So the bottom line is, steps moving forward, not a bad outcome. The Bush administration does get credit for bringing this non-proliferation issue maybe to some kind of closure. I mean, the only reason I'm not jumping up and down, and it's just that the North Koreans have a tendency to kind of take these 3 steps forward and then 2 steps back or whatever combination of those things. So, we could be here a month from now and they've had another idea about disablement and we could be back to different, but it looks like things are moving forward for now, so it's a good thing.
Yeah, I'm actually cautiously optimistic. I mean, I don't think the North Koreans have ever been really all that complicated. I mean, I think they've been frustrating, irritating, difficult, but
not emotionally complicated.
No. They're greedy.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. And winter's coming, and they need that fuel oil.
Yeah, so, hey.
Right, so...
I think there's always been a deal to be had there. I mean, it's the argument has always been it's distasteful, right, to buy somebody off. But, it's international politics. If buying people off is the worst thing you ever do...
Right, especially with home heating oil, I don't know. Isn't that what Chavez is doing in parts of New York City? Okay, so we want to talk about... what I was calling Bent's Spear and what you were calling the Barksdale Bombers.
Yeah.
So what happened was a B-52 took off with nuclear weapons on it. And these were small nuclear weapons, not that that makes any difference, but they were kiloton yield weapons. Right?
No.
Yeah.
I think you can select yields, but I don't think the... I don't think so. Maybe we'll have to go back and look.
Yeah, I mean, they were multiple kiloton yield, but in other words, they weren't like giant. Like it would have been a bad thing if one of them had accidentally detonated.
I mean, they were thermonuclear devices.
They were nuclear devices, but they weren't our big, huge nuclear. They weren't the big megaton yield weapons.
No, that's true. They weren't a megaton.
Okay. So do you want to just summarize quickly what happened?
Oh, okay. Wait. So we have all of these things called the Advanced Cruise Missile, which supplemented the air-launched cruise missile. And the Air Force decided they wanted to get rid of a whole bunch of advanced cruise missiles, actually the whole inventory, because they were expensive and they're stupid and we don't actually plan on using them. And so they were supposed to take the warheads off and... put the airframes on a B-52 and fly the B-52 from North Dakota to Louisiana, where they would take the empty advanced cruise missiles off and put them into storage, where they would either destroy them or repurpose them. I don't think they've decided what they want to do with them yet.
So you can see how a mistake like this might have happened, actually.
Yes, well, people didn't, it appears, ensure that the nuclear warheads were removed. And so, therefore, a B-52 loaded with apparently 6 live nuclear weapons flew from North Dakota to Louisiana, and we, you know, lost custody. We didn't know where they were.
For 6 hours.
And apparently, you know, they arrived in Louisiana, and the guys on the ground were so shocked that at first they didn't believe what they were seeing and apparently had some trouble convincing the superiors. But
right.
Yes, this was bad.
Yeah, it is a case study. And that issue about them having difficulty convincing their chain of command that these were actual nuclear weapons is a great case study, I think, as you pointed out in your blog, for international, for organizational theorists,
right.
Especially. They can write, dissertations can come out of this. But so a message was sent, a bent spear message, which is the message that it's a term reserved for significant nuclear weapons incidents. And, you know, people got this message and thought it was a drill or it wasn't real or, you know, a mistake. Anyway, so that's, but I mean, is there anything that you think we need? I mean, look, you and I seem to be agreed that mistakes can happen, not a good thing, but obviously, I'm sure, you know, procedures are going to be reviewed, reports will be written. But, I mean, how worried should we be? How worried should we be about something like this happening?
How worried is tough. I mean, this is a big deal. And it's a big deal because the point is that accidents do happen. And in the nuclear weapons business, there are a lot of people who spend a lot of time saying that accidents don't happen with nuclear weapons, that the safety procedures are incredibly strict and the monitoring is incredibly good, and so there is no chance that anything like this could ever happen, and consequently that there's no chance that we would ever, you know, really lose one, or the terrorists could get a hold of them, or that, you know, they're in a crisis, there might be a miscalculation, and they would accidentally get used. And people like me, who are arms control advocates, have always pointed out that, yes, our nuclear weapons are incredibly safe, but they are still managed principally by human beings. And that means that there is always going to be an inherent risk of something going wrong. And the task for policymakers is to balance the risks of something going wrong, right, which is the bad part of nuclear weapons, with the good stuff that you get, which is deterring bad guys. And so you make choices about how you do business. You know, and during the Cold War, we made some dumb choices. There's the famous example where a U.S. inspection team goes to Europe and they discover that basically there is a plane on a tarmac fully loaded with nuclear weapons and fuel and a foreign pilot sitting on the cockpit. And the only U.S. control is a sentry at the end of the runway with a rifle. And the inspection team thought that that was the wrong choice. I mean, the people who had proposed this thought we have to be ready to deter the Soviets. And we concluded as a country that we don't need to be quite that ready. And this raises a new question, which is, you know, are we, given that the challenge now is not keeping the Soviets out of Europe, it's keeping nuclear weapons out of the hands of people like Al-Qaeda or the Iranians, then, you know, do you really need things that are capable of being on alert? You know, the bomber force doesn't stand the same alerts that it did during the Cold War. But at the same time, you know, we still have this capacity for global strike where we think we can turn around a mission in a day or so. You know, do we need even that level of alert?
But it wasn't really the alert issue as much as it was the issue of, well, it was a combination
well, we
of the
don't
two,
know.
But it was the issue.
The issue is that
moving,
I mean,
out
let me
go ahead.
No, I don't mean like let me talk. I mean like let me be clear, because I maybe didn't do a great job of that, and, you know, I'm blabbering on for way too long. But if you come at this from the perspective of normal accidents theory, you just believe that certain safety procedures produce certain kinds of risks. And the fact is that if you have, you know, if you have warheads sitting on missiles and the missiles are in close proximity to aircraft and crews train loading those things on and sending them out, then you inherently run the risk when you do something like, say, load, you know, take the warheads off, load them on, and send them down. You know, you create certain kinds of regular risks. And so, you know, I would prefer much, much lower levels of alert and much, much higher levels of surety where warheads are seldom, if ever, on missiles.
Right.
And you know, that may not be something we can do unilaterally, but to me, that's the goal.
I guess we really don't know a lot about how our warhead alerts work. I mean, how often does this happen? I don't think it's anything close to a daily occurrence. I would imagine that it's probably on the order of like once a month or something that they have drills and things like this. But I guess we don't really know. And this is one of those, you know, sort of blacked out areas of nuclear weapons policy, and you know that we're just not going to be privy to.
I guess the last thing I would say is, the Air Force is going to fire people, and there's going to be an Air Force investigation, and that's great. But ultimately, they're not going to take an objective look at the policies and the procedures, right? Because
you think so?
They're given a mission, and they try to balance those risks.
I don't know. I wouldn't conclude that necessarily. I mean, I just don't know. I mean, I would think that if they really take an honest look at this, then there's a likelihood that they'll say in the future, you know, we shouldn't do them as often or do them differently. I mean, I think that's entirely possible, at least.
Well, maybe I'm wrong. It seems to me, though, that there's a certain level at which the President and the Secretary of Defense set requirements, and the military does their best to meet them. And they may make small adjustments within that framework. But I actually think Congress needs to take a much tougher look at, you know, not the question of how many exercises are appropriate, but, you know, take a second look at really where the priorities we place in terms of having a ready force that's capable of deterring. And this other, I think, equally important interest, you know, not only that we're always able to use them when we want to, but that we never use them when we don't. And to me, that's above the Air Force's pay grade.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just, look, the guys who did this screwed up, and they clearly deserve to be punished, but you know, if this is I think I wrote on my blog, if this is a broader organizational pathology, then that's like screaming at someone who's sick, you know. This is really the responsibility of the President, the Secretary of Defense, and Congress in their oversight role to make sure we have a policy that appropriately balances deterrence and surety.
Yeah. No, I would completely agree with you. I hope people aren't going to think I was being too glib in the beginning. It's just that I just do think that there's a tendency to kind of overreact sometimes when incidents occur, and you sort of create a solution in search of a problem. And it just isn't clear. I just don't think we know enough about how nuclear weapons are handled in these contexts to make, you know, informed conclusions about what's wrong with this, with the current system. But anyway, what were the other, there were two other issues. I know we're running close to running out of time. We wanted to talk about India a little bit and maybe the reliable replacement warhead.
Yeah, although, you know, I mean, my spiel on the RRW is pretty close to my spiel I just finished.
Yeah. Well, do you want to talk a little bit about India?
Sure. Nice country. A lot of poverty. Good food.
Not so. I mean, India is like roaring. Its economy is just blowing past every other economy in the world in terms of growth, and I think it's a fascinating, you know, country of disparities between poverty and wealth and, you know, places like Bangalore with their, you know, high-tech Silicon Valley, you know, side, sort of side by side with, you know, subsistence farmers who are, you know, illiterate or, you know, I think it's a really fascinating place. But of course, our narrow interest is the nuclear cooperation agreement between the U.S. and India. And is there the news here that I'm aware of, maybe you're aware of different news, is that, Daryl Kimball at Arms Control Today, did he testify before? He published an editorial, I guess, in the latest issue that got some attention in India and in other places, basically explaining, you know, why the deal is bad. And in India, there have been some protests from the left against the deal, which I'm not quite sure I understand where the Indian left is coming from on this. But do you want to say anything about the status of the agreement or what your feeling is about it? I mean, I can fill in as well.
I'm not crazy about it. I mean, it's the thing about a negotiation between two parties is you actually expect that one of the parties in the negotiation will negotiate. And it doesn't really seem that we did that. I mean, as far as I can tell, we gave the Indians more or less everything they asked for.
Maybe we should just like do like a quick primer on sort of the big picture, what's wrong with the deal. So the big picture is the U.S., India is not a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It's point number one. So India's facilities are not currently under the same kinds of IAEA safeguards that other NPT members are. And India is a nuclear weapons state. It's tested weapons, and it has a long history of since the 1970s of nuclear weapons development. And under this deal with the U.S., India gets access to advanced technology, advanced reactor technology, and it gets to sort of cordon off pieces of its nuclear program from IAEA safeguards. It gets to sort of designate what's going to be subject to safeguards inspections and what's going to be subject to its own military program. And therein lies the big problem, of course, because nuclear fuel and other things that India is now able to will be able to import eventually once this deal is fully signed, it will free up resources for its military program. So you want to take it from there? And
I think that's it's an excellent summary. I mean, the thing that I dislike most about the deal is that we grant India the advance right to reprocess the spent fuel, which is to pull out the plutonium from the spent fuel that can be used to make bombs. And the kind of fig leaf, this, by the way, is a right we only give to Euratom, you know, which is like Germany and France, right, and then Japan. I mean, nobody else do we say in advance, yes, go ahead and pull out the plutonium. And they have to do this in a special facility that they're going to build. So arguably, the plutonium that they pull out of the fuel, you know, that we provide, they can't use in their military program. But I mean, the fact is, they're going to develop all of this reprocessing expertise.
Right.
And you know, there's nothing to stop them from building a facility right next door to it,
right,
or you know, heck, building, you know, one big building and just running two separate lines and just treating it as an accounting measure. And so, you know, I mean, yes, India already has nuclear weapons, but, I mean, much as David was saying about Iran, I mean, it's sort of,
well,
you know, distasteful,
really
making
it
easy.
Well, this really takes the whole double standard problem and really exacerbates it. Because
well, right. I mean,
Brazil is a member of the NPT
right.
in good standing. India is not a player at all. And so for a country like Iran, who's looking for other examples, you know, this is a really, really bad precedent.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of the Non-Proliferation Treaty is if you want the peaceful benefits of nuclear power, you have to accept some responsibilities. And India has said, no, we want the benefits and none of the responsibilities.
Right.
And, you know, at least until a few years ago, the world was not cool with that. Now if you kind of say, like, what the heck.
And, you know, the other point that the U.S. lost in the negotiations leading up to this deal was the issue of India testing a weapon, abrogating the deal.
Yes,
I think now
that's
there's
right.
some, like, finesse.
I forgot about
there's
that.
Some language. I don't know what it is, but there's some basically finesse to this. Like, they don't, like, the agreement doesn't say test, but it says something else. And everyone sort of has maybe a tacit understanding. But the bottom line is, wow, I mean, has the U.S. won any point?
Yeah. What? It's worse than that, actually. I mean, there is the oblique reference to it is sort of in this section about, like, what happens if the U.S. cuts off, what happens if India does something and the U.S. chooses to end cooperation.
Right.
And that's our reference to if you test a nuclear weapon. And they got wording in there that actually says, you know, we would take into account if the changed strategic environment might have pushed India to do this.
Oh, great. Yeah.
So, I mean, it, basically the language is if China resumes testing,
right,
we'll be
right,
cool
right.
with India starting too.
Right.
And, you know, like, China's a signatory to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. I mean, they have a treaty agreement not to do that, but we didn't get the same agreement from the Indians, right? They are not a party to the treaty. And so it's really, to me, that's a particularly egregious problem because I'm reasonably certain India will test nuclear weapons again at some point in the future. I mean, they tested a thermonuclear device, and it failed. I mean, it was a failure. I'll get all kinds of nasty hate mail from nationalist Indians. I'm sorry, your bomb, not so good. And as a consequence, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure going forward within the Indian scientific community to test again. And, you know, this agreement, and the problem with this agreement is it assumes they aren't going to test, and in fact, they probably will.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is another example of precedent setting. That, and then, okay, here's the one final point on the India deal, and I'm not an energy expert, but I understand one of the motivating premise for this arrangement is that India's economy is roaring ahead. It has huge demand for fossil fuels, so possibly offsetting some of this demand with some nuclear power, at least for its grid, will help slacken its thirst for fossil. And apparently, this is not even close.
It's fantastic. Slacken its thirst.
It's fiction that the tiny amount of nuclear power that India is going to bring online is going to do anything to significantly impact its demand for oil. And it's in the cost benefit calculus of why we're doing this. It really is mystifying, but you know.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, the truth is there are companies that want to sell nuclear stuff to India.
Now, it's possible. It is possible. Is it possible?
Not, by the way, that they're actually going to get any of those contracts. I think those are all going to go to, you know, Russian and French firms. But
okay.
Dare to dream.
Is it possible that if there's a Democratic administration, this deal has gone so... The final deal still... There are two hurdles. Congressional approval, and the nuclear suppliers group has to meet and decide whether it's cool with this. And some members are not, but the U.S. will twist arms and kind of make everyone go along with it. I mean, I think that's the short version, even though lots of NSG members are not happy about it.
Right.
But is it possible that a Democratic administration could derail this yet?
I wish I could say yes, but I don't think that...
It's been signed. It's been signed at a head of government level.
Well, I mean, nobody wants to be... I mean, you know... In a way, there's an aspect of the agreement that I'm really sympathetic to, which is, you know, India is the world's largest democracy, and we ought to have good relations with the Indians. And nobody wants to have bad relations with India. And so, to the extent that the agreement is sold just as improving bilateral relations, like, everybody's for that. And in particular, I mean, one of the wonderful things I think we've seen in the last, you know, 20 or 30 years is a huge influx of Indian Americans, right, which is superb. I mean, you know, I am a big fan of having a multicultural society, and I think you best understand other cultures when, you know, you have citizens who have a background there, and all of that is fantastic. And that's a great boon to having a great relationship with India, which we haven't had in the past and really should have. But then the problem is, you know, we lost the debate about whether that relationship should be about cooperation in all kinds of areas that I would support, and instead it became about, you know, supporting the nuclear program.
There are all kinds of ways, I think, and I'm not like an India-U.S., but I just from the little I've read, there are all kinds of ways in which India throws up very protectionist barriers to trade with the United States, and actually doesn't take good positions on environmental treaty issues, making the argument that because we're a developing nation and you've already screwed up the environment, you know, we need to kind of we can't sign on to things like Kyoto and other global warming remediation efforts because we're still trying to get where you are. And I agree with you that I agree with you. Of course, we want great relations with India, but I it does seem like at what cost? And there are. It's not clear to me that all of the advantages are really lining up where they ought to be. I guess we're out of time. Do we want to? You know, the one thing on reliable warhead replacement, I found that I haven't had a chance to read it. The Congressional Research Service did this big report. The CRS report on, if someone's really interested in the reliable replacement warhead, we can put a link up on the site. And do you want to just, before we stop, do you want to say anything about it, or should we just let people read the CRS report? Fabulous.
I don't know. I mean, it's such a long and involved. Yeah, I think I'm going to let it go.
Yeah, maybe the next time we can explain about why we need to replace, should the U.S. be replacing its nuclear warheads? What's the impetus for it? What are the considerations? Is it a good idea? Is it bad policy? You know, what's the, what our view is. Otherwise, you know, you've written about it on your blog.
Oh, yes.
We haven't, at ISIS, we haven't done anything on RRW, easier to say.
Given the title Science and International Security.
We should.
It's really science and nonproliferation, isn't it?
Is international security different from nonproliferation? Security is broader. International security does include,
It is important to talk about their weapons, but unlike we have done just now, we also have to talk about our weapons.
Right, that's right. Well, which we did today. So.
We did. Yes, the ones we lost.
Yeah, it was good. This was like a good dialogue for me, and that I wasn't talking about burkinis, Islamic bathing suits. So I'm really happy. I now there won't be any hate mail about my feelings about women wearing Islamically correct bathing suits. I'm happy about that.
Well, I'm just pleased that you silently endured my rant about the Barksdale bombs.
No, that was good. I think it was well put. So, all right. Well, thanks.
Sure. Real pleasure.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.